industrial accidents,
ancient
solving
poisoners,
crime,
poison
chemical
prevention.
Spills. This is Toxic History.
Dr. Simon Ostrowski is a second-year medical toxicology fellow at the University of Pittsburgh. He obtained his medical doctorate from the University of Massachusetts and completed his emergency medicine residency at the University of Pittsburgh. Thank you to Dr. Ostrowski.
So thank you for that introduction. And Adam, thank you so much for having me. I've been a longtime follower of this podcast. Excited to be on it. So today we will be discussing the 1943 bombing in Bari, Italy, the mustard gas poisoning, its cover-up, and the discovery of modern chemotherapeutics. I have no disclosures. The year is 1943. World War II has been raging in Europe for 4 years, and by May, the Allies have secured North Africa and are advancing through the Italian mainland. By December, the Allies were stuck in a slog against the entrenched Nazi defenders in the mountainous Italian terrain. There was increasing fear among Allied leadership that, if faced with desperate circumstances, Hitler could resort to the use of chemical weapons. Churchill and Roosevelt had both publicly proclaimed that any use of chemical weapons by Axis forces would be met with retaliation with the same. Secretly, in October 1943, the White House signs off on a large-scale shipment of chemical weapons to be stored in a forward weapons cache in Foggia, Italy. About 80 miles south of Foggia is the Italian port city of Bari, located on the Adriatic coast, roughly marking the Achilles tendon of Italy's boot. It came to serve as a major hub to resupply the British and American forces engaged in combat further north. As of December 1943, the Allies had largely established dominance of the skies over Italy and felt so confident in their air superiority that on December 2, 1943, Air Marshal Sir Arthur Cunningham remarked, quote, "I would regard it as a personal affront and insult if the Luftwaffe should attempt any significant action in this area," end quote. Fatefully, additional munitions had been recently stockpiled in Bari to support a new offensive front. By 7:35 p.m. that same evening, just hours after Sir Arthur Cunningham made his remarks, the only anti-aircraft gun in the port began firing as multiple German bombers flew low and fast overhead, dropping several bombs along the port and in the harbor. Several massive explosions rocked the small port town as the harbor erupted in flame. A fuel line in the harbor ruptured, sending thousands of gallons of fuel into the harbor, only to ignite, creating a sheet of fire across the water's surface. Multiple ships are immediately damaged or destroyed, including the American Liberty ship, the John Harvey, which, unbeknownst to most in the port that night, carried a secret weapon. Desperate sailors dove into the oil-covered water to swim for safety, coating themselves in slick petroleum in the process. As casualties began to mount, Bari's local military hospitals were quickly overwhelmed to the point that, in one hospital, mortally wounded soldiers were triaged to a dark, quiet hallway to die, to preserve scarce hospital resources and personnel. Those oil-slicked men who were well enough to not require urgent surgical treatment were given the standard treatment for immersion at the time, a shot of morphine, a blanket, and some hot tea. As would be observed later, no attempt was made to decontaminate or wash them, nor remove their clothes. In total, more than 440 casualties were admitted to the 98th British General Hospital that night. Many men complained of a gritty sensation and stinging of the eyes that was attributed to the burning oil in the harbor. Overnight, however, nurses and physicians began to notice patients deteriorating in unexpected ways. Men with signs of severe shock appeared uncharacteristically awake and apathetic with warm extremities. They were treated with typical shock treatments of the time, including blankets, IV fluids, and plasma, but showed no signs of meaningful response, and many died quite abruptly. Within the next 12 to 18 hours, many of the casualties initially labeled as immersion cases began developing red and inflamed-appearing skin with large fluid-filled blisters. Those with initial eye irritation developed severe eye pain, sensitivity to light, and eyelid swelling such that many were unable to see at all. Within 48 hours of the attack, 14 men had died from mysterious causes, not explainable by typical traumatic injuries of war. Fear and paranoia grew among hospital staff as they began to expect potential chemical exposure, including mustard gas. But the casualties didn't fit what was expected for mustard gas exposures at the time, namely blistering and respiratory symptoms. Signal was sent to Allied Forces headquarters requesting the presence of a chemical warfare expert. And when the dust settled after the bombing, 17 Allied ships had been destroyed, over 1,000 Allied servicemen killed, and almost 1,000 more wounded. In the ensuing days, the media would dub the incident Little Pearl Harbor for the utter destruction inflicted. Several days later, Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Alexander would receive a phone call requesting his urgent assistance in Barrie. There was worry of a mustard gas attack, and Alexander, who was currently serving as the chemical warfare consultant to General Patton's army in North Africa, was being summoned to provide his expertise. By December 7th, he was aboard a flight to the eastern coast of Italy to assist. Born in 1914, Stuart Alexander was service-oriented and academically gifted. He matriculated at Dartmouth College at age 15 and was later accepted into their medical school program, from which he graduated the top of his class. After volunteering for the draft, he joined the U.S. Army and was recruited to the Chemical Warfare Service at Edgewood Arsenal, Maryland, where he oversaw research investigating human toxicity of various chemical warfare agents. He would later be promoted to medical director of the research arm and was recruited to serve as General George Patton's chemical warfare expert during the invasion of North Africa. Upon arriving in Barrie on December 7th, Alexander was immediately taken to the 98th British General Hospital to interview and examine the afflicted men. He observed many to have well-demarcated blistering burns in areas that had contacted the water-oil mix in the harbor. The distribution and distinct appearance of the burns were not consistent with any type of thermal injury and led Alexander to quickly conclude that the men had been exposed to a blistering agent or vesicant. Arsine would be expected to cause more rapid blistering, Alexander thought, leading him to suspect the burns were more likely from a mustard agent due to the delayed onset of skin findings. Shortly after arriving, Alexander began to encounter rumors of mustard gas having been in the port that night, but any inquiries about this to his chain of command were repeatedly denied. He continued his investigation, including meticulous documentation of as many of the casualties as he could examine, and he requested autopsies for all those who died under mysterious circumstances. He ordered testing of the harbor water for mustard agents and interviewed local dock workers, engineers, shipping office staff, and continued to make inquiry with the British officers in charge of the port, all to no avail. Alexander knew the gravity of the situation extended beyond just providing an accurate diagnosis to the casualties. If a mustard agent was confirmed as the culprit, and the Allies were denying any knowledge or existence of it in the harbor that night, the implication was that Hitler had employed chemical warfare, which would represent a dramatic escalation of the conflict. Alexander eventually requested a diver be sent down to search the harbor. The diver discovered fractured munitions shells, which testing later revealed contained traces of mustard agent. American Air Force ordnance experts were able to identify the casings as those from a 100-pound American mustard gas bomb. At the same time, the results from the autopsies Alexander had ordered began to return, demonstrating a pattern of findings he felt were characteristic of mustard gas exposure, including intense sloughing of the epidermis, lack of dependent lividity, and intense hyperemia of the lungs without significant fluid in any of the bronchi or bronchioles. Mysteriously, Alexander also began to notice that the most severely ill patients demonstrated a unique finding. All had rapid and marked decline in their white blood cell lines 4 to 5 days after exposure. Despite having more or less identified the causative agent, service members continued to die, now of pneumonia and respiratory complications. Concerned with the growing urgency of the situation, Alexander sent cables to both American and British chains of command, ultimately reaching both Churchill and Roosevelt. Though Roosevelt expressed interest in the situation, Churchill openly cast doubt on Alexander's findings. In multiple exchanges of correspondence, Churchill repeatedly scrutinized and undermined Alexander's conclusions, despite accumulating supporting evidence. On December 17th, 11 days following the bombing, the British commander of the medical department received orders that all mustard gas burns be recorded only as, quote, burns by enemy action, and that all references to Stuart Alexander were to be stricken from the medical records. Alexander was informed that he would face court-martial for any further attempts to have the mustard gas exposure be made official. Though Alexander knew the truth, Allied leadership had decided the stakes were too high to risk Hitler learning of their plans to stockpile chemical weapons near the front lines. So what is mustard gas? Mustard agents, known as such for their mustardy or garlicky odor, are divided into sulfur or nitrogen mustard compounds based on the presence of sulfur or nitrogen groups. They are alkylating agents. Mechanistically, that means they cross-link DNA bases, and through this DNA cross-linking effect, they activate DNA repair mechanisms. It is through this activation of DNA repair mechanisms that we think they deplete cellular NAD plus stores, which ultimately leads to inhibition of glycolysis, ATP consumption, and cellular necrosis. First used as chemical warfare agents in 1917 in World War I in the form of sulfur mustard gas, they would later be used in various other conflicts throughout the 20th century. Exposures to mustard agents most commonly involves the eyes, skin, and respiratory tracts, with clinical manifestations including intense eye pain and irritation, eyelid spasm, hoarseness of voice, sore throat, cough, pneumonitis, and the hallmark blistering skin rash of exposed skin within hours. Nitrogen mustards are also known to cause bone marrow suppression and depletion of multiple cell lines, especially white blood cells. Interestingly, in Alexander's 1944 publication that followed his investigation, which described the clinical courses of all of Berry casualties, he concluded that the abrupt development of shock, particularly in those who did not have large areas of burns, could be attributed to the unique circumstances surrounding this exposure. Unlike mustard gas attacks of World War I, many of the men at Berry were submerged in a water-oil mix for hours, serving as a perfect solvent for a mustard agent. These men then sat in their wet clothes overnight and never underwent proper decontamination, likely causing vast increases in their absorption and subsequently observed systemic toxicity that hadn't previously been witnessed in any historic mustard gas exposures. In the year before, the spring of 1942, Alexander served as head of the medical research lab at Edgewood Arsenal when he was tasked with studying two classified chemical warfare agents that had previously been smuggled out of Nazi Germany. Later confirmed to be nitrogen mustard agents, Alexander observed the typical vesicant effects in multiple animal studies. Unexpectedly, he also observed that white blood cells would begin to rapidly and severely decline, beginning 4 to 5 days after exposure. Recognizing the potential therapeutic application of this leukopenic effect, Alexander published his findings as a classified memo and attempted to meet with Dr. Milton Charles Winternitz, former dean of Yale School of Medicine and well-respected chemical warfare expert, to discuss his findings. Winternitz unfortunately dismissed Alexander's findings as more likely to be due to shoddy research than a groundbreaking development. Frustrated, Alexander tabled further cancer research efforts and was ultimately assigned a role as chemical weapons consultant for Patton. Unbeknownst to Alexander, Winternitz was engaged in a similar line of research. As supervisor of one of the labs chosen to research chemical weapons, Winternitz assigned two Yale pharmacologists, Lewis S. Goodman and Alfred Gilman Sr., to conduct animal studies on the nitrogen mustard agent, which was cryptically classified only as, quote, substance X. At about the same time that Alexander was conducting his own investigation into nitrogen mustard's effect, Goodman and Gilman were observing similar findings. Buoyed by some success in their animal model research of nitrogen mustard's effect on cancer, Goodman and Gilman sought an opportunity to test the experimental therapy in humans. They identified patient JD, who was being treated at Yale for progressive head and neck cancer that was now impairing his ability to swallow and breathe. On August 27, 1942, Goodman and Gilman administered substance X intravenously as the first dose of systemic chemotherapy given to a human. Miraculously, patient JD showed significant shrinkage of his masses and improvement in his symptoms within a week. As Alexander would observe in Berry a year later, patient JD had precipitous declines in multiple types of blood cells beginning a week after treatment, later requiring transfusions. JD enjoyed a brief period of relief, but his tumors unfortunately returned within a month and a half of starting treatment. Despite two additional rounds of treatment with substance X, patient JD continued to decline and eventually died on December 1, 1942, 96 days after initial treatment was started. Due to wartime censorship constraints, Goodman and Gilman would not publish their findings until 1946. Though the search for a systemic chemotherapeutic agent would briefly quiet during the war, Goodman and Gilman's research and Alexander's investigation of the Berry bombing victims would serve as the foundations for a decade of significant advancements in cancer therapy. Another officer of the Chemical Warfare Service, Cornelius Dusty Rhodes, who was privy to the classified findings of Goodman and Gilman's investigation, and who served as Alexander's superior officer during his investigation at Barry, would, in 1945, become the medical director for the newly established Sloan Kettering Institute, affiliated with Memorial Hospital in New York City. Despite years of fundraising, systematic investigation of various mustard compounds, and sometimes hasty human subject testing, the nitrogen mustards failed to live up to the promise they had once held. However, this coordinated multi-institution effort to identify new chemotherapeutics marked the beginning of a fruitful period of discovery. In the next decade, cancer therapeutics such as methotrexate and 6-mercaptopurine would be discovered, both of which are still in use today. By the mid-1950s, the first alkylating agent, cyclophosphamide, would later be discovered. The catastrophe at Barry in December 1943 and its subsequent cover-up would remain shrouded in secrecy for decades. Neither Eisenhower nor Churchill publicly acknowledged the truth, even after the end of the war. Alexander's account of the Barry mustard casualties was published as a classified document in 1944 and later declassified in 1959. In 1971, retired U.S. Air Force pilot Glenn Infield wrote one of the first books about the incident, Disaster at Barry, which would in turn inspire future published works, including George Southern's Poisonous Inferno. It wasn't until 1985 that a man named Bertram Stevens, a British sailor who had been on the ship the Vulcan that night, became the first survivor of the Barry mustard gas disaster to receive any form of compensation for his injuries in the form of a pension from the British government. In 1993, the Institute of Medicine, at the request of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, would publish a report describing the Department of Defense's failure to provide appropriate follow-up medical care to those affected by the 1943 Barry catastrophe. The VA subsequently relaxed the standard of proof needed for victims of gas exposure to be compensated. However, significant challenges remained in identifying victims due to the censorship of the medical records at the time. Beyond the chemical weapons disaster at Barry, the Institute of Medicine's report would also shed light on highly controversial work done by the U.S. military's Chemical Warfare Service in experimenting on human subjects with various chemical warfare agents. The work included deliberately exposing soldiers in the field to gas attacks and testing the fraught premise that men of racial minority backgrounds may be resistant to chemical weapons due to their darker skin. Similarly controversial is the legacy of Memorial Sloan Kettering's first medical director, Cornelius Dusty Rhodes, whose legacy was irrevocably marred by a racist and troubling letter written to a colleague while living in Puerto Rico. In the letter, Rhodes expressed disdain for the Puerto Rican people and implied he had intentionally transplanted cancer into human subjects out of malice. In 2003, his name was removed from the annual prize given by the American Association for Cancer Research, and his mural has subsequently been removed from the lobby of the hospital. Stuart Alexander, the young physician who bravely investigated the mustard gas victims in Barry and confronted Winston Churchill about his denials of mustard gas in the harbor that night, eventually settled in Park Ridge, New Jersey with his wife, Bunny, who had served as a nurse throughout the war. He became a respected cardiologist, a director of local Bergen Pines County Hospital, and served in multiple leadership positions for community boards and medical societies. In 1987, inspired by a magazine article, a 17-year-old high schooler in Tucson, Arizona, requested an interview with Alexander for a high school essay contest. The subsequent essay garnered national attention and ultimately led two U.S. congressmen to petition for Alexander's efforts during the Barry disaster to be formally recognized. Though greatly unprecedented, the U.S. Army Awards Division agreed to reconsider Stuart Alexander's case over 40 years later. On May 20, 1988, in a small ceremony in the U.S. Capitol, Alexander was recognized for his efforts in investigating and caring for the casualties at Barry in 1943. 3 years later, Alexander was contacted by the British government, whose leader for years sought to discredit Alexander's findings. They finally wanted to formally honor Alexander for his work at Barry almost 50 years prior, but this would never come to be. Stuart Alexander died while on the island of Mustique with his family on December 6, 1991, from melanoma he had diagnosed himself. Though it would be overly simplistic to suggest that Stuart Alexander's work was solely responsible for the discovery of modern chemotherapy, his diligent work investigating the Barry bombing and his dogged persistence in advocating for the truth not only averted drastic escalation of the war, but also served as proof for hundreds of victims of the disaster to subsequently access medical care and much deserved, albeit belated, compensation. During his 1988 award ceremony, Alexander was quoted as saying, "This award is not something I ever sought. I did what I saw as my duty at the time, as I always have all my life." Thank you all. These are my references.